Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. This week, the Trudeau government unveiled a key element of its plan to reach its targets for the Paris Climate Agreement, and that element is carbon pricing. It's caused anger in some provinces and within the federal opposition. We begin our show speaking with Environment Minister Catherine McKenna, who defends the plan and tells us more environmental measures are on the way. One of the members of the committee studying electoral reform is frustrated. They're not happy people are writing off any chance the parties will come to a consensus on a new voting system for our country. Green Party leader Elizabeth May tells us there's still hope. The Trudeau government is being accused of being more secretive about the mission against ISIS than the Harper Conservatives. That comes after a briefing from the armed forces in which the military revealed our troops have been involved in firefights but gave few other details. Conservative MP James Bazan is here calling for more transparency. And finally, who is Canada's best prime minister? McLean's has released its third ever ranking of the prime ministers in which experts scored every PM our country has ever had. So who finished first, and where do Justin Trudeau and Stephen Harper rank? McLean's reporter Nikki Weert is here to let us know. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. On Monday, the federal government dropped what some are framing as a climate bombshell on the provinces. As the federal environment minister met with her provincial counterparts in Montreal, the prime minister stood in the House of Commons and announced that by 2018, provinces will have to put a price on carbon or implement a strict cap-and-trade system.
The government proposes that the price on carbon pollution should start at a minimum of $10 per ton in 2018, rising by $10 each year to $50 per ton in 2022. Provinces and territories that choose cap-and-trade systems will need to decrease emissions in line to both Canada's target and to the reductions expected in jurisdictions that choose a price-based system. If neither price nor cap-and-trade is in place by 2018, the Government of Canada will implement a price in that jurisdiction.
After the announcement, three provincial ministers from Saskatchewan, Newfoundland, and Nova Scotia immediately walked out of the Montreal meeting, furious the government would make a surprise move like this. Saskatchewan Premier Brad Wall is using the strongest language to oppose the plan, calling it a betrayal, and saying his Justice Department is looking at its legal options. Meanwhile, Conservative critic Ed Fast claims this is all just a tax grab that will hurt the pocketbooks of Canadian families.
So what the Prime Minister had the opportunity to do is show real leadership by saying, listen, we want to do our part. One part of our policy is to address the issue of incenting Canadians to use less in terms of fossil fuels. And he could have imposed a requirement that every single additional dollar raised would be returned to taxpayers in another form. He didn't do that. So I believe that that policy is bound to failure, especially now that the provinces and territories are fighting him on this. Many of them are saying, listen, you wanted us to consult with you. You committed to collaboration. You committed to cooperative federalism. You committed to partnerships. And then you pulled the rug out from underneath us in Montreal. That's unacceptable.
The feds dismissed the claims by the Conservatives, saying the party is just playing politics and all revenues will be given directly back to the provinces. Despite the criticisms, on Wednesday, the Paris Agreement was put to a vote in the House of Commons and easily passed by a vote of 207 to 81. To talk more about the government's plan to price carbon and whether or not more environmental initiatives are on the way, I'm joined on the phone now by Environment Minister Catherine McKenna. Minister McKenna, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I guess you must be happy that the Paris Agreement has now been ratified for Canada.
I am really proud that we ratified the Paris Agreement. As we worked really hard to go in Paris to get an ambitious agreement with the provinces and territories and Indigenous leaders and business and environmentalists. And what's really exciting is that we were able to push us over the finish line. So now the Paris Agreement is going to come into a force. So it's very, very exciting that we were such an important part of it.
So let's talk about, I guess, how we're going to be reaching those targets. And I guess, first of all, the controversy that's been around the announcement of the carbon pricing plan that the Prime Minister announced. Provinces were taken aback by this, saying they were gathered, thinking that they were going to be negotiating this a little bit further, and then an implementation plan was dropped on them. How is this not like a strategy that was taken by the Harper Conservatives? Prime example, the finance minister did something similar when they announced changes to the health transfers.
So we have been talking with the provinces and territories since the meeting in Vancouver between the Prime Minister and the Premiers. They tasked us to talk to develop a path forward on pricing pollution. And we've had, week after week, our officials have been meeting. I've met as a group with my counterparts, the environment ministers from all the provinces and territories, and also individually. And we know there are only two ways that you can have a price on carbon pollution directly. You can either have a direct price like Alberta and British Columbia have, or you can have a cap and trade system like Ontario and Quebec have. But within that, there's a lot of flexibility for provinces to design their own system. And critically important, very important that people understand, that it's up to the provinces to determine what they're going to do with the revenues that they would get. So for example, British Columbia, from their carbon price, they give back the money in the form of tax cuts to families and to businesses. So there's ways to design a system that makes sense for each province.
But why not implement a revenue neutrality clause if you're already forcing the provinces to choose one strategy or the other? You have the ability to do that.
So I think it's important to note that 80% of Canadians already live in a jurisdiction where there's a price on pollution, where the governments there, the provincial governments, have determined how best to use the revenues. So as we said, British Columbia has said, you know, we're going to give the revenue back in the form of tax cuts. And Ontario and Quebec have decided they want to invest in clean tech and renewables and innovation. And I think that's really up to the provinces to determine what they should do. And that's why we're saying design a system that makes sense for you. We're happy to work with you. You understand the economic realities in your own province. You understand, you know, the businesses that are there and you know, how you need to work with them. And that's really all we're saying. And we're going to continue working with the provinces and territories and talking about how we move forward. And it's far beyond putting a price on pollution. We know that there are other measures that we need to be taking together so that we can meet our international obligations.
Did the government get an economic assessment of what carbon pricing would mean for the country as a whole?
So what we've done is we've looked at how do we meet our international obligations, how do we reduce emissions across the board, and everyone knew that putting a price on pollution, carbon pollution, was part of it. That was agreed by the Prime Minister with the Premiers. And so we know that we still have work to do, so putting a price on pollution is part of it, but we know we need to reduce emissions in other areas so that we can meet our targets, so that's what we're doing.
But did you get an economic assessment to see what this kind of plan would do to the economy?
Well, as I said, it's really up to, because the revenues go back to the provinces, they can decide what to do with the revenues. So it can be revenue neutral. You can give the money back to you know, provinces can decide to give the money in the form of tax cuts. Our focus is really on the modeling on how do you meet our emissions reductions target. And we feel that, you know, carbon pricing, what we've put forward, is a very reasonable model. And then we need to do other things. And we need to reduce emissions, we know, in the building sector, so in our houses, in our buildings, they can be much more energy efficient, which will also save money. We know we need to tackle the transport sector. Actually, very exciting. ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, came up with a plan, a cap and trade system, to reduce emissions in the aviation sector. We know that, you know, that in terms of the electricity sector, we want clean electricity. So there's a lot of other work that we need to do. I know there's a lot of focus on the politics around carbon pricing, but we're just moving forward and focusing on how we support families, communities, how we make good investments in the workplace to reduce emissions, because Canadians want to see action. They've been calling for action, and for the last 10 years, we've been going in the wrong direction. And now we are seen in the world showing real leadership about how you grow your economy in a clean way, create good jobs, support the middle class, while also tackling the biggest challenge of our generation.
So let's talk about the emissions targets and how we're going to get there. Exactly how many megatons of emissions will carbon pricing take out of the atmosphere? Because we have to get to 30% below 2005 levels by 2030. That equals out to about 200 megatons a year. Out of that 200 megatons, how much are you hoping that the carbon pricing plan will take out of the atmosphere?
Well, so carbon pricing, as I've said, is only going to be part of the puzzle. It actually, you know, reduces our emissions, especially as, it, you know, we know that it needs to increase in stringency over time. But there are many other things that, you know, we need to be looking at. And that's why we've already started. So we've made investments in, for example, public transit. For the city of Ottawa, where I am, it's going to be the investment in light rail transit is going to be the largest reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the city's history. So working with the cities, we can reduce emissions. We brought in methane regulations. We're bringing in methane regulations. We agreed with the U.S. and Mexico to reduce methane by 40 to 45% from the oil and gas sector. That's part of the puzzle. So, I mean, it really takes some thoughtful work. That's why we're taking the time necessary, working with the provinces and territories, recognizing their unique circumstances, to come up with a plan that's going to put together, meet our international obligations, but also grow our economy.
But Minister, I'm just asking in specific, has your department done an assessment to see how many megatons of emissions carbon pricing will be able to take out of our atmosphere?
So we have done modeling across the board, looking at what carbon pricing impacts it will have. Clearly, you know, if you wanted to just have a solution based on carbon pricing, some economists have suggested that the price would be extremely high. And we don't think that that's the right way to go. So our plan that you will see, I'm not going to pre-announce it, but you will see announced by the, you know, in the fall by the Prime Minister with the Premiers, is a plan that's going to get there to meet our target with reductions across sectors and across regions.
So when the Prime Minister does meet with the Premiers, that's when we're going to get more details? Because I know environmental economists say $50 a ton is simply not enough. So are you planning to maybe increase that beyond 2022? Or what other measures could we expect out of this?
So we agree that carbon pricing isn't going to be the whole solution. And we've decided that we need to do, there are low-hanging fruits when it comes to emissions that we are not building very energy-efficient buildings and homes, the transport sector. So yes, there are working groups. So there are working groups that we're working on carbon pricing, that we're working on how you reduce emissions in other sectors, and that how do you reduce emissions, how do you adapt to the impacts of climate change, because we're already seeing the impacts across the country, which will require significant investments that the federal government is prepared to make, and also how do you invest in innovation so that we grow our economy and create clean jobs. Those working group reports were part of our meeting, the meeting that I had with environment ministers. They set the framework, and we're going to be moving forward on them with the provinces and territories, because there was broad agreement with the ministers that, you know, this is setting us up for actually taking serious action that's going to grow our economy.
If a province doesn't go through with their own modeling plan or their own plan, and the federal government imposes carbon pricing on a province, what are the levers you're going to have for enforcement? What exactly will we be looking at here? Because we don't have those details. Will it be an increase to gas taxes? Will it be on industry itself, not so much on the consumer? Where is the government going to be implementing these prices on the provinces?
So we're continuing to work with the provinces and territories so that they can help design a system that works for them. That is obviously the optimal way to do this. We're continuing to have conversations with all the provinces and territories. You've seen the Northwest Territories and the Nunavut say they're very interested. We have officials working with them. We're working with Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and working across the board to help design proper systems. And you know what? It's a real opportunity for the provinces, because this is going to position them well. It's going to position them that what is you know, where are the opportunities? So in Saskatchewan, we know the agriculture sector is doing really great work in terms of, you know, building, creating climate-resistant crops. And those are opportunities to export solutions. So, you know, they should design a system that's going to move, you know, each province should design a system that's going to move them in the right direction because business is calling for it. So we have businesses, including energy companies across the country, the big banks, consumer goods companies who are saying put a price on solution because that's the cheapest way for us to reduce emissions and we'll innovate. And the innovation is what's going to create new jobs, and it's really going to position us well, not just solutions here, but solutions that we're going to export. And we want to make sure that we're positioning ourselves not for tomorrow, but for the next 50, 100 years.
Minister, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was Environment Minister Catherine McKenna speaking about the Trudeau government's carbon pricing plan and its efforts to meet the targets set out in the Paris Climate Agreement. Still to come on the show, one MP says despite pessimistic headlines, there is still hope for the committee in charge of studying how to change Canada's voting system. We also speak with a Conservative MP who claims the Liberals are being more secretive about the mission against ISIS than when his party was in power. And Maclean's is out with its third ever ranking of the prime ministers. We'll let you know who tops the list of the best PMs our country has ever had. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, questions are being raised about transparency after the military refuses to release information about troop activity in our mission against ISIS. And later, we'll tell you who tops the list as Maclean's reveals its rankings of the prime ministers. But first, at the start of this fall session of Parliament, electoral reform loomed large. Justin Trudeau's promise of changing the way Canadians vote was one of the hottest political issues on the agenda. But if you feel like you haven't heard about it in weeks, you're not alone. A special House committee, which has been touring the country holding hearings on options for new ways to elect MPs, has barely caused a ripple. And that annoys Green Party leader Elizabeth May. She thinks one reason the media is not focusing on the committee is because some journalists have already written off any chance the parties can put their differences aside and come to some sort of consensus on a new way to hold elections. Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with Elizabeth May this week when she was in Charlottetown, PEI, with the committee.
We've had no media coverage at all. We've been in Regina, Winnipeg, Toronto, Quebec City, Joliet, Whitehorse, Victoria, Vancouver, Edmonton, Yellowknife, Montreal, St. John's, Halifax. And I thought that this process would generate its own form of the country is engaged in something. This is big. We had hundreds of people coming out with doing, in addition to being like a standard committee, I'm looking at the big square table, we have the translators, the whole traveling committee travels, right? So we have expert witnesses, but we also have open mic sessions where anyone can show up and get 2 minutes at the mic. And in most communities, we've gotten at least 80 people at the mic with 2 minutes each. Look, I wouldn't sign on to this committee to kill myself on this road tour and miss being in Parliament to vote on things I care about. I knew the Paris Accord was going to pass, but Nathaniel Erskine Smith's bill mattered to me. And I think, you know, I'm doing something that is probably the most physically grueling thing I've done other than an election campaign in my life. And I'm not doing it because I think there's no chance it's going to work. I'm doing it because I believe we will write, as MPs, a consensus report of 12 people from five parties who actually have put a lot of effort into listening to, at this point, hundreds of witnesses. I don't know why the media.
Why do you think that that's? Why are you confident there'll be a consensus report? Because
I think that my colleagues are good people, and this is a responsibility we have as parliamentarians. We've been given a mandate, and the mandate is to say, look, we're changing our election system. 2015 is the last election held under first past the post. What's the fairest and best system for Canada? And, you know, I find my colleagues very open-minded in every party. The one difficulty is that the Conservatives say no matter what we pick, it has to go to a referendum. But when you pull that piece back and park it somewhere, Gerard Deltel and Scott Reed are very interested in PR. They've supported it for years.
What's your timetable now? You're done with the road trip just after Thanksgiving, and then it's into writing? Is that where you're
at? That's right. Well, we have a couple more witnesses that still wanted to be heard, and we may have some more witnesses heard in Ottawa. But we get back from Iqaluit October 18th, and that night we're in camera 5:30 to 8:30, and every weeknight we're in camera 5:30 to 8:30 till beginning of November, and we're giving instructions to drafters and starting to write, and then we have to have it translated and tabled December 1st. So we have a tight timeline. I wish we had more people. I wish we had more media people giving us the benefit of a doubt that we can actually pull this off. You know, we've had a first past the post voting for years has benefited either the Liberals or the Conservatives back and forth like a ping pong ball, and this is the first time we've had a federal party elected to government with a commitment in the platform that they're going to get rid of first past the post. It's rather exciting, and it has gotten a lot of young people come out to the microphones in our hearings. People are really hopeful that this is going to happen, and they show up, you know, nerds to the hilt saying mixed sort of proportional is a good system, but single transferable vote has this benefit. If you adapt it to Canada, it would look like this. I mean, they're really into the details. And then some people aren't into the details. They just say, whatever you do, I don't want to ever have to vote strategically again. I don't want to hold my nose while I'm voting. Please.
That was Green Party leader Elizabeth May speaking with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Still to come, we speak with a Conservative MP who is accusing the Liberals of being hypocritical when it comes to transparency with our military mission against ISIS. And the rankings are out. McLean surveyed more than 100 experts to find out who has been Canada's best Prime Minister. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, we let you know which Prime Minister has been ranked the best in our country's history. But first, this week, top military officials revealed that Canadian Special Forces troops have repeatedly come under fire in Iraq. This as they train and assist Kurdish Peshmerga fighters who are in combat battling ISIS terrorists. Defense Minister Harjeet Sajjan said afterwards that Canadian soldiers are closer to operations, as Iraqi forces, including those Kurdish fighters, prepare for a final assault to try and recapture the key strategic city of Mosul. But very little was disclosed about the specific risks that face Canadian troops on this training mission. No detail on the number of times they've come under fire, or even how many of them are actually in the field. That level of secrecy drew an angry response from Conservative defense critic James Bazan. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with Bazan about the issue, along with other pressing matters of defense.
I wanted to talk to you today partly because you made a fairly strong statement after the latest briefing from people at National Defense Headquarters on Canadian operations in Iraq. Can you just sketch, people might not have heard that, what your objection is to the way that briefing was handled?
Well, as we found out through the technical briefing, and as we've heard now from Minister Sajjan, the Liberal government will not be allowing the Canadian Armed Forces to release any information as to the operations that our Special Operation Forces are involved in Operation Impact in Iraq. As it was said that the Special Operation Forces have moved from a training mission to an advise and assist and command and control mission at or near the front lines with the Kurdish Peshmerga and Iraqi security forces. Now, we aren't opposed to that type of activity because that's what we originally sent our troops over there to do.
You're good with them being out on the front lines in that kind of role.
They are more than competent, and we're very proud of the brave men and women who serve in the Canadian Armed Forces and the work that they're doing in defeating ISIS. But what we're concerned about is a hypocrisy coming from the Liberal government, who used to complain to us that we never were transparent enough, even though we did 19 technical briefings in the time that we were government on the activities of Operation Impact. And ultimately, this talks to the larger narrative that's been set here by the Liberal government. They're duplicitous. They say one thing and do the exact opposite. They said they're going to be more transparent, and when it comes to our Canadian Armed Forces, they're not. They say that we're going to find out what's going to happen on the peacekeeping mission, and we're still waiting for when and where. And nor are they respecting Parliament. There's been absolutely no chance for a debate or a vote on any of the operations of the Canadian Armed Forces, including the change in tactic that they've taken in Operation Impact in Iraq.
Mr. Bazan, can I just interrupt just for a second? You make a string of interesting points there, I think very interesting. But just for clarity here, so I'm reading a quote from Brigadier General Peter Daw from yesterday's briefing. He's a deputy commander of Canadian Special Operations Command. And this is his explanation for why they're not coming forward with additional information on exactly what those Canadian Special Forces people are doing in the field. He says, "We are dealing with a very crafty, well-informed enemy," that would be ISIS or Daesh or whatever word we're going to use for them now, "who are able to determine patterns in terms of our presence at the forward line, determine some sort of techniques, tactics, and procedures if we divulge too much of our specific time spent on the line or specific numbers of engagements." So it sounds like he's saying times have changed in Iraq. You know, the nature of the fight is different now than it was before, and it's become more dicey to talk in specifics of what Canadian troops are doing there. You don't buy that?
Well, it was pointed out over a year ago that ISIS was a very sophisticated organization, that they're very well run, and that they are able to glean all sorts of information from the media, as well as from their own intelligence as to the activities of Canadian forces. Mm. We have to keep in mind that in today's technology, and with everybody on social media, that the ability for the Canadian Armed Forces to keep this under wraps is going to be next to impossible. And secondly, our coalition allies will be giving their public all sorts of briefings, and from that, media and others will be able to find out what is actually taking place in the battle for Mosul and what role the Canadian Armed Forces are playing with their Special Operation Forces. So, you know, they should be more upfront and transparent, as they said they would be. I'm not blaming our generals in any way, shape, or form. I know that they are always concerned about operational security and national security interests, but at the same time, the federal government under the Liberals can't hide behind that cloak of secrecy. They always have said, let's be more transparent, let's have keep Parliament and Canadians informed on what's happening, and yet they're doing the exact opposite.
You're obviously unhappy with the way the Liberals have managed the transition to a different role in Iraq. What sorts of issues do you think could arise when we get around to looking at a peacekeeping role, maybe in one of those quite complex and fragile countries in Africa?
Well, you know, John, we just wrapped up our defense policy review consultations across this country and had over 50 roundtables from coast to coast. And through that process, we heard over and over again from veterans, from current serving members, from academics, that the nostalgic view of peacekeeping that the Liberals have no longer exists. Walking around with blue berets and holding the line between two opposing forces, that doesn't exist. What we're dealing with.
Sure to interrupt. You think Minister Sajjan, he's a veteran himself, that he has that kind of sort of nostalgic view? He seems more of a realist than that, I would say, to be fair.
I would say the minister is a decorated veteran and definitely understands the combat theater more than anyone else, having done both. Bosnia under a NATO mission, not under a peacekeeping mission, and through tours through Afghanistan. But definitely those within the Prime Minister's office and the Prime Minister himself, crave for the days of Syrian era peacekeeping. When in reality, what we're dealing with is very dangerous situations. You know, we need to be going over. If we go into a peacekeeping mission, they have to be under Canadian command. They can't be tied up under UN bureaucracy like we witnessed in Rwanda. We don't need to repeat the mistakes the UN continues to make in peacekeeping missions. And so, for that reason, and what we hear from former generals and chiefs of defense staff is that, you know, Canadian troops should not be under UN command at any point.
Just so I'm clear, are you leading yourself to a position where the Conservative Party would be against a UN-led peacekeeping mission for Canada no matter what? You don't think we should be out under UN in a UN-mandated situation? Or is it a command and control question about who's actually in charge of that mission? How do you frame that?
It's definitely about command and control, and it's about what we're going to be doing there. Mm. If we're going to be put into a situation in Mali or Congo or the Central African Republic where it is extremely dangerous, and if we are tied in with bureaucratic decisions on whether or not we can protect civilians and protect ourselves, it becomes very convoluted and one that becomes extremely dangerous for our troops. If we're going over there in a supportive role in a command structure or in a training structure in an off out of theater situation, I think would be much more telling and that for our Canada and our national interests than actually standing on the ground in a very dangerous theater with our hands tied behind our backs under UN rules of engagement.
Could I ambush you with one more question on a defense subject since I've got you on the phone? You've recently suggested that it's urgent for Canada to move ahead quite quickly. I think you said within 12 months on making its decision on buying a new fighter jet. Can you explain that for me? Why the urgency? Why the need to go fast, and do you think the F-35 should still be in the mix of jets that we look at buying?
So I really believe, and what we heard is that we need to make the decision on an open and fair competition that allows the F-35 to compete against all the other fighter jet manufacturers out there. They shouldn't be excluded, despite the fact that the Liberals promised not to buy the F-35. And we need to send a clear signal to our Royal Canadian Air Force, as well as to the aerospace industry in Canada, as to what fighter jet will be pursuing. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that there's a capability gap, because everything that we've seen and heard from the Royal Canadian Air Force, including General Hood, is that there is no capability gap, that CF-18s with life extensions that are taking place right now will be able to serve beyond 2025. But there is definitely an advantage to making a decision before some of the fighter jets are taken out of production, like the Super Hornet, which is near the end of its production line, if we want to actually have them as part of that competition. And there's also an advantage to making the decision if we buy the F-35 as the other strong option, as all our allies are buying F-35s, and getting them involved in one of the mass block purchases that take place where there is a significant cost savings in buying that airframe, along with other allies at the same time.
That was Conservative defense critic James Bazan. Coming up after the break, who's the best prime minister our country's ever had? Maclean's has ranked all 23 people who have held the post, and we'll give you the results in just a few minutes. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Who is Canada's best Prime Minister? That's a question that everyone seems to have an opinion on, and in pubs around Ottawa, answering that could lead to a bar brawl. But Maclean's magazine decided to have that question posed to dozens of academics and journalists in the magazine's third ranking of the Prime Ministers. We created similar lists back in 1997 and in 2011. But to speak more about the list we've just released, I'm joined now by Maclean's reporter, Nikki Weert. Nikki, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's start off by taking a look at, you know, sort of who did the ranking and how this all came about.
So we have two professors at the university in Ottawa here, Carleton University, Norman Hilmer and Stephen Atsey, who have done the rankings in 1997, in 2011, and again this year. So what they did was sent out a survey to 123 academics, journalists, political, historical experts to get them to rank the prime ministers, and then from there compiled the list to the ones that we posted online.
All right, so we've had about 23 prime ministers through our country's history, and I guess it's best to take a look at the lists and who really made the cut. And I'm going to bring it up here on Macleans.ca. Now, Nikki, we don't just have one long list here. We've split it up this year. Is that correct?
Yeah. So for the first time, the Hilmer and ATSI did a short-serving prime minister list and a long-term prime minister list. So people who are in office for the full 4 years or more.
Yeah, and I guess that's only fair because people who served for 1, 2, 3 terms would have a lot of time to do, I guess, greater things for the country than someone who was there less than a year.
Or days.
All right, so let's start off with a long-serving list. Who made the cut here?
Sure. So we have Bennett coming in at last place. He came in right in 1930, the beginning of the Great Depression. Wasn't a great time to come in. So he is number 13, last on the list for the long-term prime ministers. You know, you go up, we have Alexander Mackenzie, we have John Diefenbaker. Number 10, Stephen Harper. And he rated actually number 11 in the 2011 list. So he's bumped up a spot to number 10.
But still hovering around that same mark, nonetheless.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so then in 9, we have Robert Borden. Brian Mulroney, number 8. Jean Chrétien, number 7. Louis Saint-Laurent, also known as Uncle Louis, during his time at number 6. Who made the top 5?
We have Lester Pearson with number 5. Pierre Trudeau, number 4. Canada's founding father, John A. Macdonald, number 3, Wilfrid Laurier, number 2, and then Mackenzie King, number 1.
Why did John A. Macdonald, Wilfrid Laurier, and William Lyon Mackenzie King outrank all the others?
Well, first off, they were in power for a really, really long time. So they had a lot of time to take on those big issues. Macdonald and Laurier really helped build Canada. So, of course, they're remembered fondly by historians and by political minds. Norman Hilmer goes over why these three men keep making the top three consistently.
All the prime ministers who get high marks have one thing in common, and that is that they stood for something and they achieved something. And in order to stand for something in legacy terms, and to achieve things that last, you have to be in power for a long time. So Macdonald, 21 years, King almost 22 years, Laurier, 15 years. That's a long time. If Justin Trudeau is prime minister as long as Mackenzie King was, he'll still be prime minister in the 2030s. Each of these prime ministers, and it's also true of Pearson and Pierre Trudeau and Brian Mulroney, all of these prime ministers have erected monuments, free trade or the welfare state, or in the case of Macdonald and Laurier, building a country where there was no country before them.
So, Nikki, another interesting thing is that there seems to be a generational divide about where some of these prime ministers rank on this list. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Hilmer and ATSI told me that among the younger experts, Pierre Trudeau and Pearson actually bumped out Macdonald and tied for third place. And they said this might have a lot to do with the fact that Macdonald's Indigenous policies, you know, back when Canada was first being formed, were not very friendly. And, you know, Pearson and Trudeau are both responsible for that modern Canada that we know today.
Let's take a look now at the short-term prime ministers, who seem to be there for less than a full term. What do we have here? Because there are only 10 of them.
Yeah, so it's a list of 10. Kim Campbell right at the bottom, John Turner, Mackenzie Bowell, John Abbott, Charles Tupper, Joe Clark, Arthur Mahon. Actually, don't know if I said that name right.
Meehan.
No, I definitely did not say that name right. Then going up, John Thompson, Paul Martin, and hitting number 1, very surprisingly, Justin Trudeau. He's only been in power for 11 months, or almost a year.
And all of these rankings are between 1 and 5, and Justin Trudeau hit 3.27, which actually outranks Stephen Harper, who came in at, I believe, 2.97.
Yeah.
So that's, I find that interesting that Trudeau's only been in power for a short amount of time, and yet he's already outranking Harper.
We're just coming out of the Harper period. It's still very fresh. I think it's important to note that Trudeau hasn't had enough time to really screw up yet, to, if that makes sense. Here's Hilmer talking about why that new fresh smell gives him an advantage.
We've just rejected Harper. We've just consigned him to the dustbin, not of necessarily of history, but the dustbin of contemporary political life. And one of the reasons he lost was that he had become tremendously unpopular and personally unpopular. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that Justin Trudeau is just outshining everyone now. But it also has to do with the fact that most Canadian academics are probably left of center, and they can remember, it's part of their fabric, what happened with Mike Duffy in the Senate, or what happened with Harper's environmental policies, or the NECAB ban, or the barbaric cultural practices hotline. These are all very vivid in people's minds. And so the closer you come to the memory of an expert, the more likely you are to find negative views. And that's why it's so interesting that Trudeau has so few negative views, even though he's been in power for, well, coming up to a year. And if you look at the opinion polls of his father after a year, he's way, way ahead of the game. Trudeau-mania version 1 didn't last very long. Trudeau-mania version 2 is lasting rather longer.
So oftentimes, I mean, people would look at something like this and say, oh, there has to be some sort of political bias. How do you respond to that?
It didn't really actually matter what the political leanings of the experts were. Here's Atsi explaining that in a bit more depth.
We talk about the experts. Most of our experts have a left-leaning background, but there were a significant number of conservatives who completed the survey, and even among the conservatives, Harper doesn't do well. Harper was in 10th place among the conservatives who responded to our survey. So it's striking. Yes, the academics tend to be liberals and New Democrats, and yet even when we pull the liberals and New Democrats out of the study, we get a very similar ranking. Laurier, MacDonald, and King are still in the top three spots, and Harper is still way down near the bottom.
Finally, we have two federal leadership races underway. We have the NDP looking for someone to replace Thomas Mulcair, and of course the Conservatives, they still have to find somebody to permanently replace Stephen Harper. Both parties hope to wipe out the Liberals in the next election. So what can hopefuls really learn from this list?
Interestingly enough, Atsi points out that charisma doesn't matter that much. It's about standing for something. Here he is explaining a little bit more about the traits that leadership hopefuls should have.
Mackenzie King was the black hole of charisma, and he places at the top of the list. So I think that trying to appeal on those grounds to Canadians isn't particularly, it's not a particularly useful approach. Standing for clear-cut policy ideas is important. Prime ministers who rested their laurels on managerial competence, like Louis Saint-Laurent, haven't done all that well, despite the fact that Saint-Laurent ran a very effective government for many years. He didn't seem to stand for any particular issue. So you need a particular issue, and you need to be able to bring Canadians together. The prime ministers who've done well were all good at forging consensus around their particular set of ideas.
So if people want to learn more about this list or the rankings of Canadians and the analysis that goes along with it, where can they find that information?
Well, we have a full spread in Maclean's magazine this week in the print edition, as well as a couple of pieces online that people can check out on Maclean's.ca.
Nikki Weert, a reporter with Maclean's, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.